I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we are joined by Andrew T. Andrew is a TV writer and the creator and co-host of the podcast, Yo, Is This Racist? We talk today about Andrew's journey from neuroscience major at Columbia to his writer's room on Mixdish to his past with white authors and so much more. The Stacks Book Club pick for December is A Little Devil in America by Hanif Abdurraqib. We will be discussing the book on Wednesday, December 29th with Andrew T. If you want more of The Stacks, you can find bonus episodes, a Discord community, virtual book clubs, and more over on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/thestacks to join The Stacks Pack. I'd also like to give a quick shout out to our newest members of The Stacks Pack. Shalewa McCall, Anna Siskind, Kai Burton, Kimberly Pritchard, Michelle Garcia, Alina Prochazabowski, Tony Marie Wahlberg, and Liz Hutcherson. The Stacks is an independent podcast, so I really could not make this show without you all and the rest of the Stacks Pack. So thank you. All right. I'm excited for you all to meet the one and only Andrew T. All right, everybody. I'm very excited. I am here today with writer, podcaster, friend of the show, I don't know, all the great things. I'm here with Andrew T. Andrew, welcome to The Stacks.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm really excited because this is sort of like the culmination of a months long kind of back and forth conversation between you and I about books and things. So now you're really here.
Yeah.
You've made it into the real book space and we're going to do this.
I guess, yeah, the A side of this conversation happened on various Yo, Is This Racist? And Yo, Is This Racist? Adjacent platforms. But I do feel like I needed that. So essentially, I had the admission that the hard realization, but also when I think it was the first time Tracy was a guest on the show.
Yeah.
I basically was in the middle of a crisis, having realized over the pandemic two things. One is that I hadn't read anything at all for several years that wasn't somehow work related. Like I'd read books, but it was always with, not something that I would have read had I not been like trying to get a job on a TV show adaptation of it, or like, you know,
right.
There was always an ulterior motive, work related ulterior motive. And truly, I think that was like, God, I mean, shameful to admit, but like, I feel like I said out loud 3 or 4 years, there's a real chance it was like closer to 8, 5, 6 years, like just like for so long. And part of it is, I think I was like you know, kind of barely finding my feet as like a writer. And so just like every waking moment was consumed with like writing or like reading about writing or trying to get a job or something like that. And I was reading a lot of scripts. So, and like watching a lot of TV and movies. So yeah, so it's just very shameful. So anyway, which is all to say, you came on and gave me an incredible recommendation list of things to read. Oh, I'm sorry. And there was a second thing, which is in pandemic, I had that realization. I was like, well, that's fine. I have all this free time. I'm going to get some reading done. And then I looked at my like existing books on my bookshelf, you know, including some of the kind of like picked it up, but hadn't read yet. And I was like, oh, this is overwhelmingly white people, white men specifically. And so I was like, oh God, this is real bad. So yeah, anyway, and now, which is all to say, you came on and gave me an incredible, me and the listeners really gave everybody an incredible suggestion, list of books. And I've been kind of working my way through it and I'm only genuinely sort of now feeling like capable of being a guest on the Stacks, like having read something that wasn't for fucking work. And like, I guess, honestly, like kind of enjoying reading again.
Yay.
Because I think it was just like one of those things where it was not fun to me, like reading books for work.
I want you to tell people a little bit about yourself. So can you tell us maybe like where you're from and maybe what you do for work? Just give us a little rundown.
Yeah, this is a fucking, let's do it. So I'm from Michigan. I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is like a university town. And, you know, my parents met there in grad school and just sort of stayed.
Wow.
But Michigan is not like super Asian. There are folks who are Asian, but not a ton, Actually, and as a kid, I think this might be a little interesting to people, is that like, because I had immigrant parents, I think I'm going to assume this is because I had immigrant parents. Well, I'm about to say something that's a little wrong, but I still think it's somehow related to this, which is that like my parents like did not really, I think, get or understand like Western media, gender roles in Western media. Mm. So I have a sister who's 2 years younger, and I just, as a kid, like I read all of my books, but I read all of her books as well. So like I'm someone who like read every single Babysitter's Club book,
yes,
at least until some cutoff. I don't remember when she stopped buying them. And like, I didn't really process I just kind of read everything that was in the house. Sometimes not even really liking it that much. I think it was just like reading all the time. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, for a long time, I like as a kid, I read a lot of girls' books. Actually, it's very weird because my mom is very like, my mom kind of handled all this stuff, is very sort of like heteronormative gender roles, you know, born in the 40s type person. But also she took me to figure skating classes and synchronized swimming classes with my sister as a child. Yeah. Anyway, so I read everything in the house.
I love that.
But it's still like very like boy centric. I think I like, you know, though I read every Babysitter's Club, I probably like read The Hobbit 3 or 4 times.
Okay.
Things like that. Like I was still, so yeah, it's just very, anyway, the upshot is like, I never really like think about what kind of books I like until honestly, like when the first time we were talking about it, it was like, oh shit, what do I like? I really know.
I know when I asked you were like, I like books about things. I was like, this is not helpful.
No. Yeah. But that really is how my brain works.
Yeah.
Like I just like, I, and that has been, yeah, it's just that I never really thought about what kind of reader I am.
Wait, and you said your parents are immigrants.
Recently.
Where are your parents from?
Yeah. I'm from Hong Kong and, I guess my dad was raised in Taiwan.
Okay.
So they met here, but they're, you know, pretty Chinese.
Got it.
And then I went to college in New York at Columbia, which has sort of like one of those like very white guy, like great books programs. Mm-hmm. So which everyone has to take a like sort of truncated classics curriculum.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's still pretty like, it's like 2 years of essentially like a great books type course and then like art history and music history.
Wow.
And something else. It's a lot of stuff, but it is one of those, like, I realized actually, because Columbia is one of those like Ivy League schools that knows that isn't, you know, where the geniuses go. And really what it is that curriculum is so that like stockbrokers mm-hmm. can have something to talk about when they like meet smart people.
Wait.
It's really like the point of that fucking curriculum, at least in modern times.
What did you major in?
I majored in neuroscience.
What the fuck?
When I was in late high school, I guess, like probably junior, sophomore, sort of, not to get ahead of the questions, but I really, really, really liked the popular science books of Richard Dawkins, specifically The Selfish Gene, because it really like very clearly explained evolution and how it works. And so I got to college sort of being like really inspired by that sort of like Oliver Sacks, like that type of book. Richard Dawkins, Oliver Sacks, I guess, are the two main ones in that sphere, at least that I knew of.
But then how did you become a writer of TV and comedy and things?
So I think what happened was like along the lines of the like realizing what like Columbia it was as a school. It's sort of that too. It's like I majored in neuroscience because I thought I was going to be a scientist.
Right.
And it became like really clear that everyone else in the major was just sort of a grade grubbing wannabe physician. And if anyone's heard me on, actually I've talked about this on several other podcasts, I have like very little respect for physicians as people. Not little respect, but I'm sort of, and part of it is I have a bunch of like doctors in the family, and it's like they're mechanics. Like mm-hmm. they're mechanics with very high stakes, but they are not, you know, you do not need to be exceptionally smart to be a doctor.
My husband is a doctor, and I can co-sign this. Though he is exceptionally smart, but a lot of his friends.
Yeah, you don't have to be. It's the system. The system works fairly well, but you know, all the ways that it fails is because of the bias in the cogs and that bias. I mean, I think the way I think of it is there's a person who I went to undergrad with who is I believe a successful doctor now, and he would cheat off me in biology class. And I'm like, this motherfucker, like,
right.
A doctor now? Like, give me a fucking break. But also it's like, you know, all my family members, I'm like, they're okay. But You know, you don't have to be smart to be a doctor.
Right.
Anyway, so I hated everyone in the major, except actually for the one person who I kind of got along with did not maintain a friendship with this person or anything, is now, I believe, disgraced science writer Jonah Lehrer was like one of my only like, kind of friends.
He was lying.
Yeah, right? He plagiarized some stuff and like fabricated some stuff, kind of probably not like super consequentially, except in as much as he was writing in a journalistic way about it.
Yeah,
but it wasn't quite like like the other like fantasists and plagiarists of that era, I think.
So I read a book called So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and we did the book on the podcast, and there's a huge chapter on him.
Oh, okay.
About what happened. I can't exactly remember the details because it was a few years back that we did it. But I think you're right. It was like he was making claims about things that were plagiarized and also weren't. He had plagiarized and then like made some false claims, like weren't really backed up about. But it was like in a book, I believe, that he wrote. And
yeah. The one that I remember, which is particularly bonkers, was he like fabricated a Bob Dylan lyric.
Yes, that's right. A Bob Dylan quote. Like, a Bob Dylan quote.
Sure. Yeah. Which is like, if you know that your audience is fucking NPR people, essentially, why would you step into that easily falsifiable territory, especially for that particular audience?
And it was like the quote was so basic. It was like I love playing guitar, said Bob Dylan. And it was like, okay, we don't even need this quote.
it was like a weird, like clearly it was just sort of like more the ethical step rather than the like the specifics of the. And I if I recall, that is all he did. I don't know. Anyway. It was just very
funny.
Anyways,
he's your friend. Like, he's your best friend.
He was, yeah, exactly. But he was going to be, he actually, for a time, had the job that I thought I wanted before I actually studied neuroscience, which is, he was the guy that, like, was sort of the media face of talking about neuroscience.
I see.
Or whatever. But I hated all those people, but I was too deep into the major to, like, get out. Right. And so for the rest of my second half of my undergraduate career, besides like grudgingly finishing up the neuroscience stuff, I was like trying to be a photographer. So I like took a bunch of classes with actually some other now disgraced faculty at Columbia. I deserve my tuition back.
Yes, you do.
As I'm talking, I'm like, give me my fucking money back, because
this was a scam.
I mean, yeah, but like truly so much like disgrace connected. And this one I think is more like, I guess I should say allegedly, because I heard this secondhand, but yeah, it sounds, the behavior I'd heard comports with what I would imagine this person could be capable of, but I guess I don't know. But yeah, so I took a bunch of photography classes, and like I was like, I'm going to be this kind of artist. And I spent all of my 20s living in New York, working a day job at Comedy Central as like a, essentially like a website producer. And I'll just age myself and say this was in the era when that was not a cool job. It was like before real shit was online. And yeah, then they moved me out to LA. I started meeting working comedy writers, and I was like, hold on, I could fucking do this. And somewhere in there, I started writing the blog Yo's This Racist that became the podcast Yo's This Racist. And sort of concurrently, this is where I'd have to like sit down and stare at a timeline to remember exactly the order. But the podcast opened enough doors to, you know, get me into the first baby steps in the Hollywood machine. And then I wrote some scripts and got hired to write on the show Mixed-ish on ABC. So about to hopefully, you know, keep writing TV, which is good, because God knows what else I would do at this point in my life. But yeah, also in there, so as I started the Yo's This Racist podcast by myself, but somewhere a couple of years ago, well, many years ago now, probably longer than not, my co-host, Tawny Newsome, who is how I met Tracy, became part of the show. And yeah, that has just been what I do. But yeah, so, and the Yo's This Racist is essentially Tawny and I answering questions about whether things are racist from people. And like most advice columns shows, it's never really about the question. It's about the conversation that is spurred by the heart of the question. And yeah. That's, I think
you did it.
Is that a full catch up? Yeah.
I think so.
Oh my gosh.
Your life story. For everybody who's like, that name, Tawny Newsome sounds familiar. Tawny was on this show, if you're an OG Stacks listener, back in January 2019, and we did Home Fire on the show. So a lot of you who are OGs, you loved Tawny in that episode. So check it out if you haven't. But yeah, I know Tawny. She used to take my flywheel class. And so it's a very weird, random, like, connection, but I'm so glad that it exists. Okay, I want to talk about Yo, Is This Racist? Because you talk about racism every week for years now. And I just want to know, do you ever get tired of talking about it? Like, are you ever just like, I don't want to do this? Like, it's so fucking enraging sometimes. And I have to get on here and pretend like it's like funny and cute sometimes. So I'm curious how that works for you.
Well, I think that feeling has diminished a little bit since Tawny got on board. And that is because, so in, before when it was solo with guests, sometimes there were just weeks where it was like, I don't, we can't do this shit. Like, right. I just don't want to. It's not good. But sort of two things happen, which is like, one, Tawny joining sort of made it so that we as friends could always have a discussion about whatever it is. And even when it's not hard, not fun. I mean, especially there were plenty of episodes last year where it was like, okay, this is what's happening. I think the other thing that is sort of nice is that because we are both comedy people, it's less of a concern. Like, we're able to not worry about whether it's funny. Like, the show doesn't have to be funny.
Right.
Which is, like, I think helpful. You know, it's the, like, we are funny people. Hopefully I'm a funny person, but you get it. Like, we're people that I think, you know, people who listen to our show enjoy listening to. And mostly we are people who are going for laughs and going for fun, but we don't have to. And another thing, actually, sort of like maybe unexpectedly, is one thing I did find, I say this glibly, or it sounds glib when I say it, but it is true, that having the show Yo, Is This Racist allows me to actually very clearly delineate a boundary in my personal life. Like, and one of the origins of the show, I guess I could back up, is like, so when I worked at Comedy Central, I was very, very, very often, not always, but very often, the only person of any type of color in the room when various things were being discussed. So I would often have to be the proxy for all people of color when shit came up, either implicitly or sometimes explicitly. And it's like, I'm not, you know, often it was like, you know, about Black people. And I was like, I'm not Black. It happens that this is clearly racist and I will say it, you know, but it's not that cool that I'm the only person right here to even fucking have this conversation. But now, you know, and it, there's less of it now, but it's still like when you work in comedy, you often find yourself the only person of color in the room. Or not right. Often. I mean, you know what? That's probably true for any industry, actually,
yeah,
as I say it out loud. But it is now truly a place where I can say, sorry, I'm not on the clock. Like, I can shunt that type of emotional labor to, like, you know, an hour and a half a week
right
on air. And so, though I say it lightly when people ask me something I don't want to deal with, I mean it. Like, I'll say I'm not on the clock and I will not answer their question.
Right,
like,
right.
Hopefully it's light and I could get a laugh out of it and no one is, like, upset. I guess I don't really care if they are upset or, you know, there's probably a little bit of Hollywood triangulating where I am less inclined to upset powerful people.
Right.
I'm a coward.
Sure. But, aren't we all?
But yeah, this is just, it's a little tough. But yeah, so yes, but the sort of the heart of the question is yes, but I actually find it helpful to like have the racism thing that can just be separate should I choose to.
Do you find that your friends come to you and are like, Andrew, is this thing racist? Like in everyday life that you have to use that a lot?
I think I have sort of successfully alienated the white friends that would annoyingly do that enough so that they just know not to do it / aren't my friends anymore,
right,
which is fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I tend not to have to use it very often, but it's also, I do think like, this is something I feel like I've heard you say some version of this over the last couple of years or year really as well, which is that like at least the type of like white folks that are gonna be receptive to my vibe about race have become more educated in the last like we'll call it year, 2 years.
Yeah.
Some of them since Trump, like, you know, they're for as annoying as some of those folks can be at times. Some of them have also, quote, done the work, done the reading,
right,
you know, and like whether it's like sort of necessary, but not sufficient always, but they are taking steps. And like, again, it can be good and bad. I mean, it's always actually good. It's good. It's only really bad when they think that doing some of the work means they're finished.
I listened to this. I won't name names because this is sort of mean, but I listened to this podcast. And this woman was interviewing an author who had written a book about anti-racism. And, you know, the author is a Black, she's mixed, she's Black, and I think white. She's talking about how, you know, white people need to do this, white people need to do that. And the host of the show, who is very much a white woman, was like, you know, well, what about the white people who have done the work? And I was like listening to this episode and it was so... it was such a horrible moment because I was so embarrassed for the white woman because I was like, you are fucking up so bad right now. And you think you're like defending whiteness. And I was even more just devastated for this Black woman who had written an entire book on the issue and has lived an entire life with racism, having to explain to this horrible white woman why the work is never done, and like having to do this like super elementary it just was like so horrible. So now whenever I hear like do the work, I already hated it, but now I hate it even more because it's just so embarrassing to me. Okay, this is sort of a joke question, but it's also comes from a genuine place of curiosity. On the show, Yo, Is This Racist? People like call in and ask you if things are racist. And I've done the show 3 times now. And I mean, 6 voicemails total. And they've all been racist. Is it ever not racist?
I mean, the answer is, of course not. Like, given that, you know, we live in the country we live in. I mean, the sort of like if you peel back the mechanics of how the show works, is that it will always be racist because we live in America. We lived in a country where people weren't free and on stolen land, and we're the dominant global superpower. So there is a way that it is not racist. I will say a criticism that has been leveled at the show and me specifically a lot is that the sort of this like, Yo, Is This Racist? Devalues the word racist by, you know, you call everything racist. Mm. So blah, blah, blah. And it is like a thing where they almost get it when people say that to me, because the thing is, everything is like built on a platform of white supremacy. Right. So it's a sort of a view of looking at the world, and I think the thing that hopefully sinks in for some people is that like doing something, you know, racist is obviously sort of like a juvenile term at this point. Like it doesn't really describe enough, but it's like, you know, generally upholding white supremacy is not the end of the world. Like when you do shit like that, it is sort of the like it's the process, not it's the cover up, not the crime of it. It's like we all fuck up constantly. It's okay. Like this never comes across the right way, but the person I hold up as the example of this, who is like sort of problematic in other ways with how they do it, is beloved white celebrity Lena Dunham, who. Mm. I will say, for all her flaws, like, never digs in, as far as I can tell. Like, fucks up constantly. And there's then the argument that, like, you know, the apologies are cheap and maybe the fucking up is becoming willful ignorance at a certain point. And that's, like, a reasonable rejoinder to when I say this. However, she fucks up constantly and apologizes immediately. And, you know, at least somewhat, you know, sounding like somewhat truthful, I guess. Like it sounds, it at least has the language of honesty. And look, maybe this is like just like an educated white person like weaponizing their liberal arts education. But compared to everyone else that does the shit that she does, who is in the position she's in, she is definitely like top of class.
Right. I think you're right. Lena Dunham, ugh. But
sure, but like you know.
Of course. But I think like the thing that I'm with you on is like calling someone a racist or like saying something that someone's done, I guess not calling someone racist, but saying that something that has been done is racist, to me is like so minor. Like to have done something that is racist in a moment is like, okay, so you're alive in America, you know? Yeah. And like if you really want to dig in, you know, there are ways that people of color can be prejudicial to one another. You know, it might not be racism because of the power structure and like the semantics of the whole thing, but like things that we would consider white people being racist for doing, et cetera, et cetera. Like these things happen constantly and not necessarily intentionally and sometimes very intentionally and all of that. But the trick of whiteness is that white folks have found a way to make saying anything is racist the number one insult on the face of the planet. So you can't have these like little nuanced conversations about race, because if you say racist or racism, it's like you've literally said someone is a baby killer. Like,
yeah,
couldn't be worse. So I feel like that's like where it gets really tricky is like, I would love to have more nuanced conversations about racist moments in life, but like, I can't because white people are crying because I called them a racist. Oh no. Yeah. Like, get a grip.
Well, I think the, hopefully the thing that that is like the viewpoint changer that I think maybe a lot of white folks don't think about or don't feel is like it's the difference of realizing that saying something or someone even is racist. I think a lot of white people think that's the end of the conversation.
Right.
And I think that's the beginning, the beginning of the conversation. Right.
It's like, and lying. Think, like when people talk about like how lie, like don't ever tell a lie. And like, if you say someone lied, it's like a mortal sin. But really, I'm just like, oh, you lied in this moment. Like, how can we move forward?
Yeah. Or I mean, truly, it's like, you know, you committed perjury, but let's litigate it. Let's talk about like what happened here.
Right.
So, yeah. And it's the thing, the nice thing about Yo's This Racist is that like for neither Tanya or I, we're able to like, you know, just use it as a place to say our piece.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've always been like, look, this is like fucking, we would have these conversations anyway. And it's nice to like check in with your friend once a week.
Right.
And especially over like, you know, staying locking down and like being in inside all the time. It was just like, look, at least I have one thing on the books every week where I'm like seeing someone's face.
Talking to a person.
Yeah. Okay,
we're going to transition off of this. And we do this thing every week called Ask the Stacks. I have not prepared you for this, but get ready. It's sort of what you did to me, but I was prepared, which is book recommendations. So someone's written in for a book recommendation. I'll read you what they said. This one's a little long. And then I'm going to give them three recommendations. You can give them like one. It's fine. Okay, so this comes from Holly, and they say, I am a first grade teacher, and I love reading anything that expands my worldview and makes me a better person when dealing with my students and their families. I studied both psychology and education in school, and I'm passionate about both subjects and always want to learn more about people and what made them that way. I like both fiction and nonfiction, and I find that what drags me into both is strong characters or people at the forefront. Recently, I loved Jesus Land, How We Fight for Our Lives, Minor Feelings, Homegoing, and The Office of Historical Corrections. I have never really gotten into sci-fi or anything too far into the fantasy or magical realism world. Anything involving kids, parenting, teaching is welcome. The end. So I'll start. I'll give a few.
Yeah.
I'll give a few and you can think and give some of your own. So my first one is, I know you said you're not really into sci-fi, but that sounded like a challenge to me. So I'm going to present you with Kindred by Octavia Butler. It's a little sci-fi, but it's rooted in a lot of real stuff. It's about a black woman who is time traveled back into slavery. So it's really good. It's Octavia Butler. It's good. My next one is called Cultish by Amanda Montell. And I think if you're listening to this podcast, you would have heard Amanda on the podcast 2 weeks ago. It's all about the language of fanaticism. So she's a linguist and she writes all about language and the ways that it evolves and changes and like the different linguistic tricks of cults ranging from Jonestown to Scientology to multi-level marketing companies to QAnon. And it's really, really cool. And then my last one is a book called What Doesn't Kill You by Tessa Miller. Tessa Miller has Crohn's disease. It's a book all about chronic illness. It's a memoir, but it also has a lot of researched elements. I found it really interesting, especially speaking to the point of like wanting to know more about what makes people who they are. I am ashamed to admit, but also not that ashamed that I won't admit it. I am probably very ableist. Like just because I've been lucky to be healthy and most of my family has too. And so I don't think about a lot of things like chronic illness and disability as much as I certainly should be. So this book for me really helped me to understand places where I'm lacking in understanding, but also helped me to understand the ways that other people are struggling physically, which is just something that I was not taking into consideration nearly enough. So those are my three recommendations. Andrew, what do you have for Holly?
So off the listener mentioning minor feelings, I will say I was surprised by how much I liked Interior Chinatown because it slow walked me a little bit. I the first half of it, I was like, okay. So I guess what I should say is like the way I think Minor Feelings does a really good job of capturing sort of the interior monologue of Asian American women. Mm-hmm. Interior Chinatown does a really different sort of thing. It does it in a different way, but does sort of a similar thing with Asian men, including so much of the like sort of toxic masculinity of Asian men that I think like does not really get explored in like a wide conversation very much. It's a thing where, and it's a thing that I just didn't realize I hadn't seen it like kind of worked through in media in a way. But, oh, sorry, I should say also like toxic masculinity and also a little bit of the like, it landed the anti-blackness of the Asian community in a way that I was like, really like, oh, this is, it's not doing a good job with this until it does. Right. In a way that I think those are conversations that at least for me aren't out there very much. Mm-hmm. And I was really, really glad to see it. So I think that's the thing I've read most recently that like, I think probably provides an interesting counterpoint to Minor Feelings.
Not counterpoint,
but just sort of like filling in like the, some of the specific shit that Asian men have in their heads, Asian American men have in their heads.
Right.
That, yeah.
Okay. Holly, those are your recommendations. For those of you at home, if you want to get a book recommendation on the air, email askthestacks@thestackspodcast.com. We're going to take a quick break, then we'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, we're back from our break. Okay, we're going to do the stacks question. So we start here always, two books you love, one book you hate.
Yeah, I'm going to start actually with the one book I hate with like a big ol' caveat to it. And it's a book you've brought up already. And I should say, I think I only read one chapter of it.
Oh, God.
So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
Oh, yeah. I sort of hate that book, too.
Okay.
Yeah. We talked a lot. I talked a lot of shit about it on the show. Don't worry.
Oh, good. Okay. But it's a thing where like, and I think it was more like listening to John Ronson talk about it after the fact. And it sort of took on a life of its own. And then the way it got taken up by the right wing as like, it sort of honestly was like the corners. It's a founding text of like this fake, like a anti-cancel culture. Outrage, but like the thing I hate about that book is like it was sort of the same that and Hillbilly Elegy, where just hearing like the log line essentially for the book, I was like, that book is made to comfort bigots.
Yeah.
And so I think I read one chapter, or I read like the beginning, the one about the publicist who like tweeted something racist and then was fired. And it really is just like, if you're so mad, and then everything else that I read in the book is like, yeah, the mechanics of public shaming. Okay, it takes a toll. But if you're so mad about public shame, why don't you address some of the underlying issues that cause this groundswell of rage?
Right.
Anyway, that's a book that I think like enough people I like think that, but it's always the kind of like well-meaning white people that are like, oh man, didn't you love this book? And it's like,
yeah.
This shit is.
We did it with a well-meaning white woman on this show, and it was before, it was like March 2020. And I think that I was pretty critical on the episode, but I didn't go as hard as I maybe would have liked to, because she really was appreciative of a lot of the book. But the book is fucked.
Okay.
It totally is.
I couldn't make it through it, but I was just like, this is not. This is it is like, yeah, you just kind of watch it be, you can just tell the bedfellows of the book, sort of tell you what it really is.
Yeah.
And I know it's two books you love and one book you hate, but the other one is, and I think I did allude to this on another on a Yosa's Racist episode, but I'm currently working on a podcast project where I'm reading Atlas Shrugged, and for reasons that are too dumb to get into, I'm rereading it for the second time.
Oh my God.
And good motherfucking God, it is just horrible.
So you're giving me two books you hate and one book you love.
I guess so.
Okay.
Well, that's just came to mind. I just was like thinking about it because that's what I've been
I love
doing.
Both like, hate on this show. Everyone on this show tries to be so polite, and I'm like, no, tell me a book you fucking hate. I know you hate books.
Well, I think the other thing is actually, so Maybe the other, like, looking at the psychology of it, and this is something I left out of my bio at the top this time, not on, I actually intended to mention this, but I forgot, which is, like, I also, in my 20s in New York, I was also, like, I had a lot of friends, like, right out of college who were, like, assistants at publishing houses, and so I was, like, getting a lot of books, and it was also, like, once again, to age myself, like, during that heyday of New York, like, McSweeney's and, like, Iowa Writing Workshop people coming out. And a thing that I realized when I was looking at my bookshelf is like so many of these, and I guess so they were probably like sort of Gen X white people or like old millennial white folks. And so many of those people that I like quote unquote loved when I was in my 20s are horrible like alt-right idiots now. I think specifically I remember I had a galley of a Megan Down book that I really loved in my 20s. And I just remember this like sometime during, you know, 2020, like realizing I owned it, throwing it away and being like, good fucking God. Although that being said, I still have the selfish gene on my bookshelf. But yeah, it's just so many, like, as you let these white intellectuals continue to have public life, it's like, it is weirdly troubling how many of them just fold straight into, you know, racism usually, transphobia, it seems like, is increasingly popular.
Yeah. Well, like, what's interesting too is, like, now there's this call for diversity in publishing, and what they've ended up doing is A, not getting any more diverse, big surprise, but B, finding voices of people of color that speak to the exact same thing as these, like, alt-right people from, or like pre-alt-right people. You know, it's like, I'm not saying that this person is quite as bad as, you know, John Ronson or whatever, but like, I think of like Emmanuel Acho, who is like, difficult conversations with black people, and he spends all his time coddling white people about why they're not racist. And it's like, that's not actually diversity in publishing. That's just a black person writing what a white person wishes they could write. So I find that to be an interesting twist. And there's a lot of different, you know, books like that. So sorry, Emmanuel, but you're not my fave.
I think that's kind of how it always is. It's like, it's still like, even every time, I mean, look, in Hollywood, it's arguably worse.
Yeah.
Because it's like, every time there's a push for diversity, it doesn't include diversifying the audience.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Right.
Like, you know, I will just say, like, I'm almost framing this like it's going to be shady, but it isn't. It is. But like, so I worked on the show Mixed-ish, and like, it was on ABC on primetime. And there, of course, was an acknowledgement that a significant portion of the target audience of the show is white. And so it's a thing where it's like, and I think all credit to my bosses, they really like were like, yes, but, you know, in the case of Mixed-ish, it's like telling this, like, both mixed and black point of view, and knowing that there will be some hand-holding, but doing the hand-holding in, like, the hopefully funniest and most, like, creative way. And that was, like, interesting. But it is still, like, the thing hanging over everyone's head is, like, at the end of the day, like, 10 powerful white people are going to decide whether this is palatable for the millions of white people that are hopefully watching this. So it is like a little bit of a dance. So that's the same thing. It's like, you see it all the time. It's like the audience, it's still white people, even when it's like a push for diversity, which is like, I think part of the problem. It's like not just diversifying the media, but diversifying the audience.
Yeah, totally. You haven't told me a book you love still.
Oh, yes. Well, which is all to say, I'm trying to think because it's like the sort of embarrassing shit. I think the two that I was going to say that were both like really hit me, although I'm curious whether they would hit me the same way. I'm also not a person that revisits books very often.
Yeah.
But the first would be Hardboiled Wonderland at the End of the World, Haruki Murakami.
Okay.
Which I was a little bit saving because I'm like, this also, yeah, this speaks to other questions as well. I love that book. I think I like it more than his other like books because it's maybe a little more straightforward and like a little more cinematic, maybe. But I think it was that my first exposure to like this like cool magical realism Asian person, Asian point of view that I think. Yeah, I was really inspired by that. And then another one, which is a book I also have not read in a long time. I wonder if I would hold up for me, is Colson Whitehead's The Intuitionist, which I think it must have just been I was in that time of like magical realism and people of color is what I need because I have otherwise all these confessional white people, which I think I like.
Right.
But those are the two books from that era that I think would hold up more than all the other shit that I like in my most literary time. I'm like actively embarrassed about liking and having liked. Yeah.
Okay.
I think those are my books.
Okay. And what's a book that maybe you're looking forward to reading?
I will say actually, so while we were doing this, I pulled up the physical stack, and for some reason I thought we were going to do the How We Fight for Our Lives by Saeed Jones. And I'm looking forward to reading that mainly because, like, I think I just started paying more attention to Saeed on Twitter. And like, I was on a Zoom with him like early in the pandemic. It's like, this is the most charming motherfucker.
He's so, so great.
I guess for like personal reasons, this is the book I'm going to dig into next, I think.
It's one of my favorites. It's so good. He's so great. And he is so charming and lovely and smart and wonderful and just all the things. What are you reading right now?
Honestly, nothing. I just finished another one of your recommendations, Exciting Times.
That wasn't my recommendation.
It wasn't?
Mm-mm. I don't know that book.
Oh, how do I have it then?
I don't know.
Maybe, gosh. Well,
maybe you recommended it to yourself.
I genuinely feel like this is impossible. I don't know.
Did Tawny maybe recommend it when we were talking?
I guess it's possible.
Because she recommended a few books.
I mean, I 1,000% pulled it from the big stack of the stacks recommendation that I had been just keeping there. So because it's written by a white woman, but is it
the Irish like book or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like Tawny's recommendation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was like a very fun. It is kind of just like a millennial queer romance in Hong Kong. I will say, actually, going back to my initial pathology about my reading, as I was reading it, I was like, I know it's been optioned, but I would like to, there's a couple of people I know that I would like to see take a crack at this as a movie.
I love that. Okay. Aside from me, where do you find books to pick up, or am I it for you?
You are currently it, honestly.
Okay. I love it.
Because I read in like fits and starts, and I just have too much to get through. And so far, they've all been great. Like, at no point have I been like, I don't want to do this. So I'm gonna power. I just feel like because I'm fortunate to know you, by the time I power through this, I struggle past the finish line with this stack I have, it will be not uncool for me to ask for another recommendation.
You can always ask me for recommendations. That's like all I do is skip book racks.
So that's the selfish thing is I currently have no need for anything beyond you as a book. But I think it also just like, obviously speaks to how you do this shit, that it is like they're perfect. It's so good. I think the other one that I really, really, really liked a lot, and it helped that it dovetailed with a piece of TV I liked a lot, was reading There while Reservation Dogs was airing.
Oh, There is so good.
Got me into that, like, you know, obviously superficially it's about natives, but I think there also is that, like, the children of it, the, like, again, the sort of naive, toxic masculinity of it that I really, really responded to as a double feature, essentially. I just think, like, there into Reservation Dogs was, like, fucking wonderful as a media experience.
There's supposed to be a sequel of There coming that Tommy Orange is working on. So I'm very excited. I'm not sure when. There's no title or anything, but I've heard him talk about it in a few events. Like, he's working on it.
Yeah, it feels like this is how sick and depressing Hollywood is. I would have said it would be a great TV series, except I think the existence of Reservation Dogs will, in the minds of the white gatekeepers of Hollywood, will prevent it from happening at least anytime soon.
So sad.
I guess I don't know. And maybe I'm like, you know,
I hope you're wrong.
I don't know. I do, too. Yeah. But that is just my guess.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite bookstores?
I bought a lot of stuff from, I think I bought this whole list from Stories, bookstore and cafe near me in LA.
Okay.
Is it my favorite bookstore? I think in the absence of a better candidate, I suppose, I probably don't have like an emotional attachment to bookstores the way I think some people do.
Right.
Yeah. 'Cause I think probably depressingly after buying stuff on Stories intentionally, my next biggest bookstore is Amazon, which is, I know, deeply uncool and deeply fucked up. But it is a thing where when I lived in New York, I don't even know if it must be there in some capacity, but I was a, like, go to the Strand every Saturday afternoon and just buy something.
Yeah, it's definitely still there, the Strand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I figured.
It's like an institution. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you think of the last book that made you laugh?
Oh my gosh, I can't. I was thinking about that as we were leading up to this, because I'm very much not like a, like, I think my problem is I maybe have like worked in comedy just long mm-hmm. enough where it's like, it's really rare that I laugh physically out loud yeah. at anything. But also maybe it's the nature of like the comedy comedic classics. Mm-hmm. But like, I think to me, the biggest example is Confederacy of Dunces, where
my brother loved that book. I hated it.
I couldn't get through it.
And
so many people were like, it's the funniest thing you've ever read. I'm like, I don't think it is.
It's a no.
Yeah. So it's sort of like that, like all the classic, like, this is hilarious books. Like, I rarely find them really funny. I think genuinely, I can't think of.
Do you know Samantha Irby?
What it is.
Do you know who that is? She writes for Tuca and Birdie. And she's written three books, and she writes comedy essays. And I generally hate anything that's supposed to be funny, stand-up comedy included. I like hate all forms of comedy. But her books are actually kind of funny. I listen to them on audio, and so I feel like that makes it better because she reads it. And she's really funny. And she's a writer who's funny, so her books are funny because it's in the format that she's – one of the formats that she's funny. So if you ever do want to laugh, I recommend it. But I also don't love to read funny, so I get that too.
Yeah. I'm not opposed. Yeah, I'll add that to the list. Maybe I'll make that my first audiobook.
Oh my God, yes.
I'm a very not audiobook person.
Try it, because it doesn't feel super audiobook-y, because she's reading these like personal essays, and they're very funny. Okay, what about the last book that made you cry? Or are you not a book crier either?
I'm not a book crier as much, but I probably cannot credit the book alone for this, but like last year I'd like gone through a breakup and like was like kind of deep in the like misery of being relatively buttoned up in COVID. Mm-hmm. And multiple times in Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, I was like, found myself a little weepy, but not like from any specific passage. I think it was just the grimness of it and my own. Probably the book didn't really make me cry.
Got it.
This is what I mean.
You were just an emotional place.
That's a last. That's what I was crying last at reading. So I guess that counts.
That totally counts. What about the last book that made you angry?
I mean, currently it remains Atlas Shrugged and it will be for, I think because as people have probably gathered, I'm like not a very like, I guess like kind of not a great reader. So like if anything kind of remotely makes me like my bar for putting a book down doesn't even extend to angry. Mm. Like,
yeah,
I, you know, just like a little annoyed, a little bored. And it's like, it's been gone.
Gotta go.
Like,
yeah.
I just don't know when I would. So I get angry at the idea of books. Again, have not read, so you've been publicly shamed, but I'm angry at it.
But you hate it. I love this for you.
Yeah.
Do you have, you said you've read a lot of like classics and white male books. Do you have any particular problematic fave?
I mean, I guess it would just have to be Richard Dawkins.
Okay.
Like, not a fave, but I do think The Selfish Gene, again, I have not reread it in a while, but it would be fucking shocking to me if any of his, like, later racism and transphobia is in there.
Right.
I mean, I suppose it could be, but, like, those, like, science books, I just think are, like, the most, like, lucid, like, rejoinder to, like, you know, most, you know, creationism and conspiracy theories and things like that. It's just like really like fucking clear how evolution works and could start from basic principles.
Right. What about a book that people might be surprised to know that you love?
Again, it's like one that I don't know if it would hold up so much. Okay. But I think in my teens, I really, really liked like, and this is just like pretentious, grew up in Michigan, Andrew speaking, pretentious teen surrounded by white people, which is like the Douglas Copeland novels, like, you know, Generation X, I really liked, and like Microsurfs, I think is like, is good. But he has a collection of short stories called Life After God that as a teen, I found to be very kind of romantic and cool. And I think they're probably still fine, but yeah, actually, the one audiobook I do remember really enjoying, and I still probably would be my favorite, quote unquote, favorite audiobook, is Microsurfs as read by Matthew Perry.
Wow. From Friends?
Like, yeah, like iconic. the most 90s shit that could possibly exist. But I think at the time I was also like a bit of a computer nerd, and it did not strike me as being problematic that like it's so painfully white,
right?
But yeah, I wonder, I've not done anything to disabuse myself of this like so maybe there's maybe I don't like it. It's hard to imagine. It's the same me that really liked Rushmore,
okay,
and Royal Tenenbaums, and I don't like that me for cinema. So now that as I say it out loud, there's kind of no way it would extend to literature, but that's still my answer, I guess.
Okay, I just have one more for you. We always do this one. If you could require the current president of the United States to read one book, what would it be?
Oh my God. I mean, I think it would actually be Parable of the Sower.
Okay.
I mean, it's just like Joe Biden put down the, like, you know, the Skinner liner notes, which is your normal bedtime reading. And like, right, maybe not Skinner, that's too racist, but whatever classic rock he grooves out to. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's beyond not something I need to say, but Parable of the Sower, the predictive value of that point of view vis-a-vis fascism and apocalypses was startling. It's startling. And it's like, yeah, that talks about where our society is going, has a better track record than like anything else. So right. I guess it would be that.
All right. That's it from Andrew for today. He will be back the last week of December. We're going to be discussing A Little Devil in America by Hanif Abdurraqib. My favorite book of the year, I think. I know it is my favorite. Spoiler alert. I'm going to talk about how much I love it at the end of the month. That's our book club pick. Andrew, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. This was so wonderful.
Yay. And everyone else, yes, we will see you in the stacks. All right, that does it for us today on The Stacks. Thank you all so much for listening, and thank you to Andrew for being my guest. Remember, the Stacks Book Club pick for December is A Little Devil in America by Hanif Abdurraqib. We will be discussing the book on Wednesday, December 29th with Andrew T. If you love the show and want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack. And please make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Our editor is Christian Duenas. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite. And our theme music is from Tekirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.